Vaisakha Puja, here we are, full moon of May. We just had a double ordination last night, Anagarika ordination and a Samanera ordination. So it's a kind of a double header weekend. Give a few reflections tonight just to cap off this very beautiful, long, significant weekend here at Abhayagiri. It's also Vaisakha Puja is the day that I took my ordination, my full bhikkhu ordination 27 years ago here at Abhayagiri. So it's a special day for me too, my birthday in a sense. And just nice to have others going forth on that same, on this same day, and it being such a auspicious day in the Buddhist list of holy days, one of three major observance days in the typical Buddhist calendar: Vaisakha Puja, Asala Puja, and Magha Puja. Thank you. I can plead that I'm functioning on not quite a full set of equipment here. I just had surgery a couple of weeks ago, and am in phases of recovery. So if this comes out in bits and pieces, please excuse me. But Ajahn Janako asked if I'd give a few reflections tonight, and I'm happy to do that, for better or for worse. So, but Vaisakha Puja is a particularly special observance day for us, commemorating, as I'm sure everybody here knows, the birth, enlightenment, and passing away, death of the Buddha, our teacher. And as the tradition goes, that his birth into this world, his last existence as a human being, the night of his enlightenment, and the passing away of his body this lifetime all happened on this full moon of May. So we come together. It's probably of the three, it's the most widely acknowledged and observed throughout all of the Buddhist traditions in one form or another, because of its significance. The impact that the Buddha had on the world is incomparable, from at least those of us who follow this path and have realized the benefits of his training, his teaching. It's quite a miracle, actually, that someone came into the world having put forth so many eons of preparation for being able to really fully realize on his own the realization of complete ending of suffering, and was able to establish a dispensation for all of us to gain benefit from that more than 2,500, almost 2,600 years later. So we use these kinds of days, particularly this day, as one to reestablish a sense of faith, of commitment, confidence in the path. Traditionally, you know, when we talk about recollections from this day, we can attain a sense of faith and confidence just by reflecting on the Buddha's life, his birth. There's the traditional accounting of the miracles that occurred that accompanied his birth, all the various celestial beings attending the birth, realizing that a very special being was coming into the human realm again, and that all going well, he would develop his path on this last lifetime and realize perfect enlightenment. So there was many what we would consider miracles happening in terms of the birth process and his taking his first steps as the Bodhisattva, and these were all these birth miracles, recounting this, were once the subject of a group of monks who had come together and were reminiscing, recounting the wonderful and marvelous qualities of the Buddha. And they were going through these lists of many wonderful and marvelous qualities, and including many of these birth miracles. And as they were enjoying that talk and recollecting that and finding an inspiration and uplift in that discussion, the Buddha came upon them and asked what they were talking about. And they mentioned the subject of their conversation. And the Buddha said, yes, those are all wonderful and marvelous qualities of the Tathagata, the Buddha. And he says, but there's one more wonderful and marvelous quality that you haven't mentioned. And his answer was, he says, and that wonderful and marvelous quality is that the Tathagata, the Buddha, knows a feeling as it arises, as it persists, and as it passes away. The Tathagata knows a perception as it arises, persists, and passes away. The Tathagata knows a thought as it arises, persists, and passes away. This is another wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. So I always like to remember that story because the Buddha was always one to bring it back down to a very cogent, practical application. It wasn't that he was trying to discount the joy and uplift that people experienced remembering some of these other qualities, birth qualities, but he always pulled it back down to something that was quintessential to his teaching. And in fact, in other places in the canon, those same three qualities that he was described as wonderful and marvelous were his basic definition or part of one of his definitions of sampajanya, clear knowing, clear understanding, the arising and passing of feelings, perceptions, and thoughts, and that the fact that anyone can start to contemplate that and realize that and experience that understanding for themselves. So that's oftentimes the recollection of the birth into this world, into this existence of the Buddha, a supreme teacher for all of us. And we can recollect that and appreciate that and experience just a lot of uplift and gratitude. This dispensation, this teaching was brought into the world for us to benefit from, as I say, you know, almost 2,600 years later in its many of the teachings in their original forms. The second aspect of this day, the enlightenment of the Buddha, we can recollect the night of his enlightenment and gain inspiration from that. As it's often described, the enlightenment came in three stages. That night when the Buddha, after having been on the path, searching on his own, sometimes with teachers, sometimes more on his own, but in the very end, having realized as far as he could go from some of his teachers, some of the sublime meditation states, but realizing that he hadn't penetrated to full and complete ending of dukkha, ending of suffering, and went off on his own, made the determination on the night of his enlightenment, the full moon of May, after being practicing on his own for 6 years, now at the age of 35, he made the resolution to sit under the Bodhi tree, that he would not move until he had penetrated to full and complete understanding of the Dhamma. He must have had, in my imagination, he must have had a pretty good sense that he was on the cusp after having pursued many different practices and ideas for 6 years and then gone off on his own, realizing that he had to finish the work on his own. But to make that kind of resolution not to move, he must have had some sense that I think that he had the capability, the potential for doing that and just needed to basically make that final commitment, that drive, that determination to make that full realization. So he made that determination, and then as the story goes, there were three watches of the night. And in that first watch of the night, he examined his own personal history, what we might call his narrative, his personal narrative, because he had really perfected many of the meditation aspects, and his ability to see into past lives was quite comprehensive. Some of the details of that particular content of the night are a bit sketchy, or they're just not very complete. But I have a sense that maybe he just realized this sense of dis-ease, this sense of dukkha, and was looking for some understanding of how does this all come to be? How did this all come to happen? This suffering that he experiences in his existence, this basic unsatisfactoriness of human life, of even having the best of everything in his life as a prince and all the sensual gratifications that could be had in the human realm. How, you know, where does the source of unsettledness, of dissatisfaction come from? And with his ability to see into his innumerable past lives, as the story goes anyway, he just reviewed as far back as he could possibly go, eons and eons of existence, of many past lives and different states of being, just examining, seeing his own trajectory. And he was never able to find a discoverable beginning to this. That's the way that it's phrased in the suttas sometimes, you know, from an undiscoverable beginning, beings and the Buddha himself wandering through samsara, obstructed by ignorance and hindered by craving, fettered by craving, undiscoverable beginning. And he was able to go back eons and eons and eons of time and never find an origin. So I can imagine just myself, you know, that kind of sense of, you know, wow, I've been doing this over and over and over again, the same thing over and over and over again, relentlessly, and sometimes in very exalted states of being, sometimes in very low states of being, and always experiencing the transience, the independability, undependability of living in being, existing through any different realm. So, you know, the sense of awe of the nature of his trajectory as far back as he could go, a very strong, must have been an incredible emotional realization. And then the second watch of the night, after he had completed as far as he could, reviewing his own personal narrative, the kind of expanding that same examination to the arising and passing of all beings through different planes of existence, being able to see the arising and passing of beings in different planes according to their kamma. This is where he really fully understood and experienced directly the law of kamma, that all beings, as well as including himself, but all other beings too, were experiencing the fruits of intentional activity. That is the law of kamma, where we have this quality of intention that drives us from one existence to another, creating the causes and conditions for better or for worse, for our rebirth into the next realm, one after another after another. So the law of kamma became very clear to him then, as well as the cycles, the continuing cycles of birth and death that relentlessly passed on for all beings. Adding to that impact, I think, of his realization of the noble truth of dukkha, really seeing that firsthand and penetrating that very deeply, noble truth of dukkha, and its cause, fact that he was starting to understand this deeply, this cause of this law of kamma, the basically the second noble truth, that all dukkha, all dissatisfaction is caused by one of the three forms of craving, craving for sensuality, craving for existence, bhavatana, and craving for annihilation. So that's the second watch of his night. And you can tell, I mean, these were based on his meditative powers, but the impact, the actual story is one of this incredible sense of motivation based on a deep penetration of the truth of dukkha. And then, of course, the final watch of the night, on the night of his enlightenment, where he was able to see fully, experience deeply how to relinquish the causes of dukkha, that very craving. I can only imagine that the impact, the effect on his heart of having seen how all of this suffering comes into existence, the causes and conditions leading to it, and the repetition, the relentlessness of it, gave rise to this sense of disenchantment. He'd seen through the illusion of the realm of the senses, the illusion of this craving to be, this craving to exist in the ways that we think of that. He became disenchanted. The enchantment was removed, leading to this very strong sense of dispassion for the ways of the world through clear knowing and seeing, jnana-dasana. He was able to penetrate deeply the transience of the world and what it offered, the transience of this drive to always seek fresh delight in existence, and realize that it was never ending. And he was able to relinquish, to let go of that particular drive and open up to what we call the unconditioned. The ending of the asavas was this third stage of enlightenment, or third stage on the night of enlightenment, the third watch. The ending of the outflows of movement towards sensuality, towards the outflow towards becoming, just pure becoming energy, being, existence, and the outflow of ignorance, not seeing clearly the arising and passing of all conditioned phenomena. All of those were ended. The ending of the asavas happened in that third watch, and he fully penetrated and realized that he had been following and completed the Eightfold Path, all the aspects of the Eightfold Path, to the full, not just the mundane realization of the Four Noble Truths, but the transcendent realization, where he fully and deeply saw the cause of dukkha, dukkha, the cause of dukkha, the path leading to the ending of it, and fully realizing the ending of dukkha. So this is typically what we can contemplate on Vesakha Puja, this aspect of his birth, his enlightenment, and then his passing away, and realizing that I think the inspiring thing to me in the story of his passing away is more the recollection that the Buddha was a human being too. He wasn't a god. He wasn't anything that he, you know, claimed was a, you know, superior form of any particular kind of celestial attainment or a supreme perfect god. He was a human being, and all human beings pass away at some point. And the thing that to me that's inspiring about that is that is a statement that we're all in this same condition. We all have the same potential. Maybe we don't have the eons of parami, of perfections, to become a fully enlightened Buddha. And we don't need to, thankfully, because we've got the Buddha's dispensation that marks a clear trajectory for us if we decide to take up the path. But because we are human beings, just as the Buddha was a human being, with flesh and blood body and a mind that you know, followed certain patterns, but had the same potential, the same capability of understanding the path and fully realizing that, and that we have that capability in this very lifetime. It's not easy, but the Buddha basically was there demonstrating through his humanity, his being just a human being, a perfected human being, but in that human form, and that this is the most auspicious form of birth for us to be able to follow that path that the Buddha laid out. So these are some of the traditional reflections that we can engage in and find inspiration from on this day of Vesakha Puja, the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and passing away. There's also, I think, you know, on a more day-to-day level, that I think that we can apply this reflection to, and that is on a more symbolic level, perhaps, the quality of birth. And that, you know, sometimes we think of it as birth as dukkha, which it is in a literal sense, but there's also the potential for bringing into being many, many special qualities that we need to develop along the path. We've been talking a lot, Ajahn Janako has been really emphasizing the importance of the development of virtue and gratitude and many of the qualities, the paramis, similar along the lines of what the Buddha developed over many eons, that we also work towards developing, giving birth, in a sense, to the qualities of generosity, of kindness, the reflections on gratitude and the wish to repay that, the qualities of loving kindness, the qualities of discernment, the qualities of patience, all the different qualities that we need to bring into being as part of our mind training, as part of our heart training on this path. So this is, in a sense, one of the positive aspects of becoming. We can't completely relinquish and let go and dissolve into nirvana before we really develop a full set of foundational qualities. So it's what Ajahn Jeff refers to as the paradox of becoming, to let go of the full rebirth urge to exist, that final relinquishment of all forms of becoming. We actually have to engage in a lot of becoming along skillful lines to make that possible. We can't just do it through the wish to not exist anymore. So birth, we can celebrate the fact that we can bring into being, we can bring into birth all of these skillful, supportive qualities that not only prepare us for the final relinquishment, if we take the path so far, or at least have some experience, taste of it, but also delight in the qualities in and of themselves as we develop them. They feel good. It naturally feels good to be generous, to act kindly, to follow moral precepts, to not harm other beings in any way, to be straightforward and honest. These are actually qualities that feel good right here and now, as well as serve as a basis for our development of the path. The qualities that the Buddha realized and understood on the night of his enlightenment, I think we can also, you know, work towards realizing the root causes of our own suffering, even if we can't see our multiple past lives or we can't see the rebirth and appearance and disappearance of beings according to their karma. I would suspect that most of us, if not all of us, don't have that ability. We can reflect right here and now on the dukkha in our own lives and use that as our motivation. We can experience the truth of how our wanting, our craving for sensuality, our craving for existence, our craving for just any kind of experience to quell the boredom, to quell the different moods that we feel, the different waves of irritation and anger and confusion and anxiety and fear. This is our direct experience of dukkha. And for us to be able to take the time, take the opportunity to own up to that, to really look at that. This is our first and second watch of the night, in a sense, and to see that we're not alone. That's maybe our second watch of the night, is seeing that we're not alone. Other people are experiencing these difficulties as well, and that we have a collective ability to help each other and work with each other to understand it and to, again, own up to it and to look at it honestly and without fear, and to say, okay, well, haven't I suffered long enough? Haven't I done this long enough? Isn't there another way, something that will bring me a longer sense of contentment, longer lasting sense of contentment? And then to be willing to walk that path, to open up to some difficult mind states, to see where it is, you know, that we keep on making the same errors over and over again, and to be willing to realize and acknowledge that we can't do it on our own, that we need the help of the other beings around us to do that too. We may think that we should be able to do it on our own, and we have our opinions and our views about the path and our certainty maybe about the way that we're approaching it. But unless we're really open to the feedback and the presence of other people who are also walking the path, it's very likely that we'll just get caught in our own delusions. So the first watch of our night, symbolically, is realizing and understanding the enormity of our dukkha and the fact that there's causes and conditions for that, and the realization that other people are in the same boat and that we just need to jump in and help each other to understand that. And that the final watch of our night on a daily basis is that really taking to heart the importance of letting go, of relinquishment, and realizing that the ways that we've generally been seeing the world, understanding the world, are what we need to work towards letting go of, so that we can open up to a greater truth, a greater sense of freedom, one that's long-lasting. And then symbolically, maybe on a more personal level, the death, you know, what is death of, we talk about the death of the Buddha, the parinibbana, the final passing of his body, of his khandhas, body and mind, into parinibbana. And really what we're talking about is the death of dukkha, nirodha, cessation, dukkha, nirodha, the cessation of dukkha. And that our enlightenment, our birth into good qualities, skillful qualities, our relinquishment of the unskillful qualities that keep us bound in samsara, all lead to this dukkha nirodha. In remembering Sariputta's inspired utterance of nibbana is the cessation of dukkha. Nibbana is the dukkha nirodha, essentially. The cessation of becoming. And that all forms of wanting to have sensual pleasures, all forms of wanting to just be existent, and even forms, subtle forms of wanting to annihilate and get rid of all the unpleasant. Nibbana is the cessation of that particular force, the cessation of becoming especially. So death, a sense, the death of dukkha is what we can recollect as the potential for our practice. The Buddha really encouraged us to take it as far as we can go. He didn't say, stop at just a minimal amount of stress reduction or doing a few good things to help people. All of these are part of the path, but we've been exposed to the teachings. We have the potential for full and complete realization. And as we've been admonished by many of our teachers, don't settle for mere happiness. There is a potential here for complete happiness. And if we just recollect and use the traditional recollections from the night of the Buddha's enlightenment, from the events of his birth, the potentials of his that he brought into the world for all of us, and the fact that he was a human being, just like we are, to give us that inspiration that we too can follow a path to the complete ending of dukkha. So that's what I think of the night of enlightenment, Visakha Puja, all these qualities that come forth that we can recollect to serve as an inspiration to keep on the path. So I'll leave it there for a few reflections tonight.